Welcome to the wrap-up of the MIT Stanford Venture Lab. The real-time web, imperative or insanity? I'm Andreas Weigand.
I'm Jeremy Carr.
And we try to explain to you some of the key ideas which we learned from the panel that evening.
So I thought the biggest idea that we covered was that there's a fundamental change that's happening in the nature of how people interact socially. Right now, we have Twitter and Facebook and a current trend where people are interacting in a slightly different additive way than how they had previously. But one of the things that came out from the panel is that there's actually a fundamental shift going on where people are beginning to interact in ways that were not even possible before these services existed.
The key element here is the atomization of interactions. So on the positive side, this means that the barrier of creating some content, of disseminating that content, and also of snacking on that content, the barriers have essentially disappeared. It's no longer that we have to find a stamp and lick it and send it off, but it is easily done from our mobile phone via Twitter, Postgres, whatever service we want to use.
One of the useful ways that you broke things down was you mentioned that there's the production of information, the distribution, and consumption. Could you explain that a little bit better?
Sure. On the production side, we have, with basically zero cost for certain ability, to reach potentially everybody in the world. In a given minute, about 100,000 blog posts go live. By the way, more than 90% of those in Asia, where this atomization, this microblogging, has a much longer history than the United States. And about 40,000 URLs get shortened using the Bitly service alone. And about 40,000 tweets get created in 1 minute. That's what we have on the production side.
Now let's talk a little bit about the distribution side of things.
So what's interesting for me about the distribution side is that the two endpoints of the spectrum which we had before, private and public. An example of private being that I send you a text message, Jeremy. An example of public would be that I post something on Weigand.com, which anybody can see. That those two endpoints now have something in the middle which didn't exist a couple of years ago. For an example for that would be on Thanksgiving. A friend of mine posted a note on Facebook where he thanked his friends. It was not a public note his mom could have seen. It was not a private SMS just to me, but it was something which we, as his friends, all felt enticed to explore. Why are there 500,000 shares on Facebook per minute? Do people want to express themselves? Do we go back to the social construction of reality? In this case, unlike what we had in the 60s, where it was an external social construction of reality, that I want to self-construct my reality socially.
And I think one of the important things to note with those shares is before the internet, before email, this concept of sharing is not even possible. You could directly mail one of your close friends a letter where you'd write directly to them, or you could publish in a newspaper, potentially. But this interim way of sharing, where you're only sharing to 10 friends, that did not exist before the internet. And before Facebook, the proxy for that was email. And a lot of times that had problems with spam and things like that. But we're creating the tools right now that are helping people to sift through all of these incoming links that might or might not be interesting to them.
So we know now that creation and distribution have become trivially easy for everybody. The bottleneck remains, and clearly consumption. Because the amount of attention we have or the number of minutes in the day isn't really increasing. So let's look at some consumption numbers. There are 4 million queries across search engines per minute. That is where people try to consume content. And interesting enough, there are about 100,000 Bitly links alone clicked per minute. Roughly the same number of product searches executed in Amazon.com.
Given this finite amount of attention, what are the truly revolutionary things that are going on the consumption front?
We had Topsy to class this week, which is a real-time search engine that actually leverages the attention, these second-order effects, that I find it worth to retweet something. I put my name behind the retweet, and that is actually how I create or destroy my own social capital. What we now have, which we didn't have a couple of years ago.
Another dimension that potentially is really interesting is search engines previously were primarily oriented around relevance, but now we're seeing a whole new dimension of temporality, of is this relevant in the past 10 minutes in the case of an earthquake, or is this relevant in the past minute in the case of a press release for a company? What sort of challenges is that creating for search engines?
This is one of the trade-offs which I believe are best made explicit to those users who actually understand the trade-offs and want to say, in this case, I care for relevancy where I want to have a longer window in time, so I need to collect more statistics to know what's relevant. Whereas in the other case, I just want to go for recency. I just, in the extreme case, simply want to see what is the most recent tweets which arrive somewhere, maybe in their neighborhood. So we can also filter by geography. We can filter by friends, my social filter. Relevance versus recency is one important dimension, but there are others to them. And it actually is worth it to reflect on communication in a more general sense.
I agree. Let's drill down a little bit further. What are some of the characteristics of communication that you can cut across?
We already talked about the public versus the private aspect and the emerging third dimension between them. One element with the atomization of information communication is that synchronous communication, handshake, versus asynchronous communication. For instance, in the academic publishing literature, it used to be timescale of months to get a paper out. Now, that shrunk to weeks, sometimes days, and sometimes even hours. So it becomes much more of a dialogue of communication, synchronous communication. Other dimensions about social data communication are whether data merely exists somewhere or whether they are discoverable, whether we can find them, and whether data are merely ephemeral, they come and go, or whether we have some, say, even service level agreement expectation against them being persistent.
One of the things that's come along with the real-time web is the increasing publicness of data and interactions, which has really changed how we interact with each other.
Yes, but not only how people interact with each other as friends, but it has a huge impact on the future of work. So the atomization of information which we have seen here, of course, is also true on the atomization of allowing people what to do, what they really like to do. That thing that, if it's fun, it can't be work, if it's work, it can't be fun, is, for most of the people who are listening to this recording here, a thing of the past. We, of course, have to invent some ways of how to recreate context, because sometimes out of context, things don't make sense. But that notion about chopping off things and doing what it is that people like to do is for me one of the fundamental changes. Jeremy, for instance, take the class wiki we have, where it's not you or me who write in class notes, but basically it's every single student contributing what he or she is interested in.
That wasn't really possible before wikis existed. That's a pretty amazing change.
It's an amazing change, and it truly has changed the nature of people working together. Why do they do this? What are the motivations? I think the intrinsic motivation is often the strongest one, that people want to be known for being competent, for being good, for being creative.
One of the other ways that we've changed our interactions with each other is how we interact in real space. A lot of what we've seen on the mobile front is location data about where I am right now, or where my friends are right now, or where we want to meet up. What are your thoughts about how that's evolving?
In class, 2 years ago, I committed to class that I was wearing one of these spot devices, which every 15 minutes was broadcasting my GPS coordinates, and I gave it a class project to do interesting stuff with that. That was pretty avant-garde at that stage. Now it's pretty trivial. For instance, one of the class projects is with scout.com, S-K-O-U-T.com, where people actually find other people nearby of the gender they're interested in and they're of the gender the other person is interested in, and they could have a conversation or coffee or whatever comes out of it. So that's an example where interactions between people truly get changed by information which in this case is implicitly collected but knowingly and willingly shared. And why? Because people want to see the result of that.
One of the interesting things that's done is we've evolved to not planning as much. Because we have phones now, because we know where each other are, and because we can message each other, we can plan our lives 15 minutes in advance instead of having to do that 5 hours in advance.
And in that spirit, we thank you for listening in here. If you want to know more about it, there's a Facebook page, facebook.com/socialdatarevolution. There's a website, socialdatarevolution.com. And if you want to know about me, Andreas Weigand, that's site, weigand.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening.